Is it okay now? Better? Excellent. Okay, so let's start with a motivating example from a classical situation. So assume we have given a coin, and our task is to decide whether this coin is biased or not. And somehow we also have this side information that if it is biased, then it is biased with this probability distribution. Okay? So right now, I will comment here that this is not a very, not the most realistic scenario, obviously. Thank you. Because usually what we could expect is that we know that somehow it is either some distribution around the uniform distribution, or it has some distribution on some separate set from this other set. I will focus on the simple scenario when we know exactly that the state of the system is either one state or another state for various reasons. One reason is that this is difficult enough to handle, and the other reason is that I will try to argue that this is also interesting enough to study. Okay, so let's consider this simple scenario for a moment, and let's look at a classical statistical model. We can describe our problem with having a finite set of consisting of head and tail, and we have two probability distributions on this finite set. One is the uniform distribution and the other one is biased with the given hint. And our null hypothesis is that the coin is unbiased and the true distribution is P, and the alternative hypothesis is that it is biased with the true distribution Q. Okay, and what we do is that we toss this coin n times, and based on the outcome sequence, we try to decide which is the true situation, right? So the strategy is that we fix a set of outcome sequences, and if our outcomes fall into this subset, this AN, then we will accept that our null hypothesis was right, and otherwise we reject it and accept the other hypothesis. Okay. In principle, we could also work with randomized tests. Namely, we could specify a function on the possible outcomes and accept the null hypothesis with the probability f and x, depending on the outcome of the trials. But actually, we will see that it doesn't give us any more than if you just look at this more simple scenario of specifying subsets. And if we have n trials, n toss of these coins, then we will be testing the IID extensions, p to the tensor n versus q to the tensor n, right? So let's move on to the quantum scenario. Consider a situation when we have a source that emits quantum systems, and all of them are either in the state rho, which is our null hypothesis, or in the state sigma, which is our alternative hypothesis. And somehow we know a priori that these are the only situations that can happen. And just a comment, I will use states in the sense that they are positive linear functionals on the observables, normalized so that they take one on the identity. And I will denote the corresponding density operators with this rho hat and sigma hat. Yeah, here. And if we have access to n copies of the system that this source is emitting, then our task is to decide whether the true state of this composite system is rho to the tensor n or sigma to the tensor n. And again, we are doing a binary measurement on the n-particle Hilbert space, and based on the outcome, we either accept our null hypothesis or reject it. Okay? The error, we can make two kinds of errors. Either we can reject rho when it is true, and the probability of this event is computed by this formula, and the other way around, we can accept rho while the true distribution is sigma, and the probability of this event is given by this. These are called the error probability of the first and the second kind. And it is quite easy to see that unless these density operators are orthogonal to each other, the sum of these error probabilities is always going to be strictly positive, right? And it is heuristically also quite clear that there should be a trade-off between the two. So if you want to lower one of the error probabilities, then somehow we have to pay the price of increasing the other one. And the task is to find the optimal error probabilities. But the question is, optimal in what sense? It is not a priori clear what we should call optimal. And there are indeed various notions of optimality. And probably the most studied is the optimality in the sense of Stein's lemma. So in this situation, we are imposing a constant bound on the error probabilities of the first kind, and we would like to minimize the error probabilities of the second kind under this constraint. Okay? This is an asymmetric scenario. For some reason, it is more important for us to make sure that this error probability is not going to be bigger than this epsilon. This is usually the model they are using in, I don't know, if we have a medicine and we want to decide whether it is toxic or not, then it is really important not to make one kind of mistake, and it is less dangerous to do the other kind of mistake. So this is probably why this has been the most studied situation in statistics. And the first state discrimination result in the quantum scenario, as far as I know, was done by Hiei and Petz, who have proven a version of quantum Stein's lemma, namely that they have shown that these optimal second kind of error probabilities are decaying with an exponential speed, and this exponential speed is given by the relative entropy of these two states. More precisely, they have shown a bound in one direction between these two quantities, and it was completed later by Ogawa and Nagaoka. Okay, and but the importance is twofold. One is that it gives a precise expression, a computable expression for the exponential decay rate of these optimal error probabilities, and on the other hand, it gives an operational interpretation to the quantum relative entropy. Okay. We can study this problem in a slightly different setting. So here we had a notion of optimality for each n. This is a local notion. We can define optimality asymptotically, requiring that the error probabilities of the first kind vanish asymptotically, and study the optimal exponential decay rate of the error probabilities of the second kind, where the supremum is taken over all possible sequences of measurements. Right? Of course, you might complain that this limit need not exist in general, and indeed it need not. But for simplicity, I will work with this notation. One could introduce limimph and limsup and show at the end that they are all equal to each other. And it's quite easy to see that if we know this, then we also know that this asymptotic notion of the Stein exponent coincides with the quantum relative entropy. Right? And this result has found some applications to classical quantum channel coding, which was, I think, pointed out by Hayashi, Nagaoka, and Ogawa. First of all, it is not surprising that state discrimination is related to channel coding because, or communication problems, because at the output, the receiver should somehow discriminate between the signals they have received and decide which one the input was. What is might be a bit more surprising that it is actually related to this setting when we only have two states, because in general we have several states at the output. And what happens here is that we take a finitely supported probability distribution on the input space and create this classical quantum state corresponding to this probability distribution. And the famous Hollabaugh-Schumacher-Westmoreland-Lauer bound tells that if you only allow product inputs, then the optimal transmission rate will be actually equal to this quantity, which is the mutual information in this classical quantum state, which we measure by the distance of this state from the product of its marginals, and the distance measure in this situation is the quantum relative entropy. Okay. So as I said, there might be different notions of optimality, and indeed, let's see some other one. It turns out that if we go a little bit below this optimal rate, so if we take a rate below the relative entropy, then we can find a sequence of measurements such that the optimal or the exponential decay rate of the error probabilities of the second kind are this R, and the alpha n's decay exponentially, right? And this is related to the problem of error exponent in channel coding, which is well known that if you go below the capacity, then we can find encoding and decoding such that the error probabilities decay exponentially. And it has been a a long open problem, even in classical channel coding, to determine the exact value of this exponential decay rate. So even for classical channels, it is not known. And in this setting, we might want to fix this decay rate and optimize the decay rate of these alpha ends under the constraint, or vice versa, we can fix the exponential decay rate of the alphas and look at the optimal exponential decay rate of the betas. And this we call the Hoovding exponent. And this problem has been open for a while in the quantum scenario. Hayashi and Ogawa considered some candidates to express this exponent in a closed formula, but they couldn't find the optimal solution, which was only found recently in 2006. Before I mention that, I also mention a different notion of optimality. So what we have considered before were asymmetric scenarios, right? So we imposed some constraints on the error probabilities of one kind, and we optimize the other kinds of error probabilities under this constraint. Instead of this, we might consider some symmetric scenario. So consider the situation when we have some a priori distribution on the hypothesis. And we can have a look at the Bayesian mixture of the possible error probabilities. And but again, we expect these error probabilities to decay exponentially and look at the best exponential decay rate over all possible sequences of measurements, right? You might notice that I have omitted the p and 1 minus p from here for obvious reasons. It's very easy to see that they don't matter actually. Okay, and this quantity is called the Chernoff exponent. And it has been a breakthrough in state discrimination theory some 3 years ago, when in two independent papers, one by this group and one by Nussbaum and Scola, managed to show that this exponential decay rate can actually be expressed in a closed formula and is equal to this quantity, which is called the Chernoff distance, which is defined in this way, right? So we have the two density operators here, and we are taking fractional powers. And what we have here is actually the range relative entropy, apart from a constant term. And the Chernoff distance is defined as minus the minimum of this function. I would like to comment here that we will use a convention that we take powers only on the support of the densities. So everything is well defined here, even for negative powers. And this function is a nice convex function on the whole real line. Okay. And based on these results, soon after, Hayashi and Nagaoka managed to settle the problem of the Hoovding bound, and they have shown that the Hoovding exponent is equal to something which is called the Hoovding distance, and which again can be expressed with the help of these range relative entropies. Okay. And I would like to comment a little bit on this statistical distances. So let's call this function psi, which I have already mentioned that is a convex function on the whole real line. And it turns out that we can derive many very important notions of statistical distance from this psi function. So the Chernoff distance we have already seen is the minimum of this function on the 0-1 interval. And the range relative entropies are defined as a constant time this psi function for any t different from 1. And we can get the standard relative entropy as a limit of the range relative entropies as t approaches 1. And the Hoovding distances can again be expressed as a certain transform of these range relative entropies. And actually, if you change the parameters a bit here, it turns out to be the Lejeune transform of some modified function. And because of the Bipolar theorem for Lejeune transforms, we can actually also express the range relative entropies as a transform of these Hoovding distances. So they mutually determine each other. If we know all the Hoovding distances, then we know all the range relative entropies and vice versa. And the relevant domain for the parameters of the range relative entropies are only between 0 and 1 here, right? Okay, why do we call these quantities statistical distances? One reason is that they are all non-negative, and actually most of them are also strictly positive. So this is one reason. And other reasons are that they are monotonically decreasing under stochastic maps, and they are jointly convex in their arguments due to the theorems of Lieb and Ullmann. And they all have an operational interpretation as the optimal decay rate of some error exponents in a state discrimination problem, except for the ring relative entropies, but they are closely related to some quantities which do have this operational interpretation. And what is nice, it turns out, it was pointed out by Nagaoka, I think, that from this, it is quite obvious that the operational quantities are decaying, are monotonic under stochastic maps, just by definition. And if we can establish these equalities between the operational quantities and the entropic quantities, then we get a proof for the monotonicity of the entropic quantities. And because we have such an interpretation for the Hoofding distances, and the ring relative entropies can be expressed by the Hoofding distances, then we will also have a monotonicity proof for the ring relative entropies. So this gives an alternative proof for Lieb's concavity theorem, which is entirely based on very heuristic operational arguments. Okay. And, right, so what I would like to talk about is mainly correlated states. So it seems that the problems of Steins-Lemma, Chernoff bound, and Hoofding bound is solved in the situation when we have IID quantum states. But in realistic scenarios, we might not be facing such a situation. So it's important to study correlated scenarios. For instance, in a classical setting, we might imagine that there are some correlations in the successive trials of our experiment, the simplest situation being something, a classical Markov chain. Or we can imagine a quantum source emitting a set of signals with some classical correlations in between the successive emissions. And these various scenarios can be described in the spin chain formalism. So in order to describe correlations, we have to describe correlations between two sides, three sides, four sides, whatever. If you don't know that it's a finite range correlation, then the best we can do is to to specify everything in an infinite setting. Right? So let the spin chain algebra be just the infinite tensor product of D of H for some finite dimensional Hilbert space. And we assume that we have two states on this C star algebra, which are again positive linear functionals with a normalization constraint. And in the infinite scenario, they do not have a density operator. And our null hypothesis is that the true state of the infinite system is rho, and the alternative hypothesis is that the true state of the infinite system is sigma. And what we can do is that we make n trials and try to decide, based on the result of some binary POVM, which situation we have. And for n trials, what we will see will be the restrictions of the states to n copies of this system, and they do admit some density operators. Okay, and the IID situation is contained in this formalism as a special case. Okay, we might formulate our problem in a slightly more general situation or setting. Namely, we might specify a sequence of Hilbert spaces and two sequences of states, rho and sigma, without assuming any kind of relation between these Hilbert spaces or the successive states. And we might want to distinguish between between these two scenarios, the null hypothesis being that the true state of all the systems is rho n, or the alternative hypothesis is that the true state of the systems is sigma n for all n, right? And we also specify a scale for this problem, so we might not see 1 over n times logarithm decay, but 1 over c n times logarithm decay. So for instance, what we can have in mind here is that if we have a cubic system of higher dimension, then this Cn will be n to the power of the dimension of the physical dimension of the system, and what we are looking at is that n-dimensional cubes. So we are making measurements on n-dimensional cubes, finite subsystems of our infinite system.
I'm a little confused, like, true state of the system, control, and you have a sequence
of states, yeah. Yeah, for each end we have two states on each end. So what we have in mind is the restrictions of an infinite state. Oh, yeah, to finite subsystems, basically. Okay, and again we are trying to decide based on the outcome of some measurement, and the error probabilities are the same as in the IID situation. Okay, and the error exponents are again defined exactly the same way, apart from that we have these different different CN here. Okay, with this formalism we can describe various scenarios. For instance, as we have already mentioned, the IID case is contained in this formalism, or discriminating correlated sequences of states on finitely many trials. Or alternatively, we can think of an infinite quantum system and making measurements on finite parts of the system and trying to decide which is the true state based on these measurements. Or another scenario is that when we are facing a restriction on our measurements. So all these nice results about Stein's lemma, Chernoff bond, and Hoovding bond are valid as long as we are allowed to make any measurements we want, which again might not be true in practice. And one particular scenario we have been studying when we have a restriction on the measurement is that when we have some symmetry group acting on the system and we require our measurements to be invariant under this symmetry group. So the states are still IID states, but we are not allowed to make any measurements, right? And it's quite easy to see that formally it doesn't matter if we have these IID states and restricted measurements, or we can make any measurements and restrict the states by projecting them to the invariant subalgebra. So what we can do is that we start with a one-site density operator, we look at the IID extensions and project it to the group invariant subalgebra. And this sequence of states actually extend to a correlated state on the infinite chain. So we are again in the formalism described before. And our task is to discriminate between this, well, one correlated state rho and another correlated state sigma obtained in the same way with unrestricted measurements. Okay, and there have been a few results, quite a few, dealing with correlated situations. And again, the most studied scenario is that of Stein's lemma for various reasons. So here I and Pat some time ago have already shown that if rho and sigma are completely ergodic, finitely correlated states on a spin chain, then we have this Stein's lemma. Well, completely ergodic is some kind of technical condition here. Finitely correlated is, in principle, an extension of the notion of Markovianity to the quantum scenario, though it's a bit more general than Markovianity. And it is also, yeah, these kind of states also come under the name of valence bond states, and they are closely related to matrix product states, and they have various other names in the literature. They are quite important in physical applications. And quite some time later, Bielakowicz and Zygmunt Schultz have shown that if the first state is ergodic and the other one is still IID, then we have Stein's lemma. And sometimes later, the same people, together with other collaborators, have shown that actually they have established Stein's lemma in a much more general scenario. So they allowed the null hypothesis to not to be just one single state, but to vary over a whole set of states, which is very important for applications. And the other one was still a single state satisfying some factorization property. And Fernando mentioned in his talk their version of Stein's lemma, where they managed to show Stein's lemma in the case when the null hypothesis is a single state, an IID state, and the alternative hypothesis is a set of states. And he has shown various applications of this version of Stein's lemma for quantum information theory. Okay? And what we've been interested in is to show similar results for the other notions of Chernoff bond and Hoofding bond, and also for Steinslen bond. Okay, so the goal here is to show that the operational quantities coincide with the entropic quantities, where these are defined as the regularized versions of the finite size Chernoff distance or Hoofding distance or relative entropy. And of course, it seems quite natural as a necessary condition to assume that these regularized measures exist, right? But it turns out to be almost sufficient too. So we can have a look at these local range relative entropies, and it turns out that if they have a limit on the 0-1 interval, and moreover, this limit is differentiable as a parameter of the range relative entropies, then we do have these identities. So, okay. And we could show that this condition can be verified for a few classes of states. Well, classical ergodic Markov chains are a textbook example on classical hypothesis testing. I just mentioned them here because they give the motivation to study the finitely correlated states, which somehow are expected to behave the same way, but they don't, unfortunately. And in this scenario, one can establish this convergence and differentiability based on Perron-Frobenius theorem of positive operators and perturbation theory. Right? Another class of states is the temperature states of non-interacting fermions and bosons on a cubic lattice. In particular, this includes state discrimination for Gaussian states. Right? And here the technical tools are some extensions of Segre's theorem, which is related to these Fischer-Hartwig conjectures, what we have heard in Vladimir Korepin's talk. And another class of states is Gibbs states of a spin chain with finite range translation invariant interactions, but this is treated by a different method. And we could only obtain some partial results for this group invariant scenario that I mentioned before. And, okay, so one important thing is to establish the existence of these regularized versions of the statistical distances, and this seems quite a reasonable assumption. But then here we have this differentiability assumption, and one might think a little bit about why it is there and whether it really should be there. And actually, where it comes from is a certain condition in large deviation theory. So this is a sufficient condition in Gärtner-Ellis theorem in classical large deviation theory. And this is the differentiability of the logarithmic moment generating function of some classical random variables. And this is purely a technical condition in this scenario. But on the other hand, in quantum statistical physics, one also faces this problem that we are looking at a moment-generating function, which is usually called as, free energy or pressure or these kind of things. And we are looking at the limit as the system size goes to infinity. And if you see that the limit is not differentiable with respect to some physical parameters, then we conclude that our system is critical, and otherwise we say it's non-critical. And maybe the validity of this result is that the systems these infinite states describe are non-critical. But I don't completely, it's just a speculation, because it's not clear whether this parameter T has any physical relevance or not. So in the statistical physical setting, we have the magnetization or outer magnetic field or whatever, and we are considering the derivation with respect to that, but here this is just an abstract parameter of range relative entropy, so I don't really understand what they describe. Okay, and in the remaining little time, I will try to point out one application to channel coding and then to give a little bit of insight into the general methods of these state discrimination problems. Okay, so we have already seen that Stein's lemma has found some application for proving the achievability part of the channel capacity for classical quantum channel coding. And it seems that these generalized relative entropies and other notions of state discriminations also have some importance for channel coding. So consider a classical quantum channel. So we have a set of inputs, and our channel is mapping this set of inputs to some density operators on a Hilbert space. If the range of this W is commutative, then this is a classical channel. Usually a quantum, when we are talking about a quantum channel, then we assume this X to be the state space of some input Hilbert space. We have an encoding. We have a set of messages labeled from 1 to M. We have an encoding from the messages to the input space of the channel, and we have a decoding, which is a POVM at the output. And we can define the average error probability corresponding to such an encoding and decoding. We define the single shot epsilon capacity as the maximum number of bits that we can transmit over one single use of the channel, such that this error probability stays below some bound epsilon. Okay? And what we could show is that we could find a lower bound on this one shot epsilon capacity, which has the following expression. So here we are, instead of the relative entropy, we are using a Hoofding distance with some parameter that depends on this epsilon. And as usual, for a finitely supported probability distribution, we assign this classical quantum state and the product of the marginals of the state. So this is again the distance of this classical quantum state from the product of its marginals. But here the distance is measured by another way than the relative entropy. So this is a mutual information in a classical state using this Hoofding distance. And we have a correction factor, which depends on epsilon. So you might notice that if epsilon is very small, then this whole thing is going to go to infinity, minus infinity. So it's not very useful. But it's also not very surprising, because if you are only allowed to use a channel once, then for very small epsilons, we might not be able to transmit any information with probability less than epsilon, even if the asymptotic capacity of the channel is quite large, right? And what is kind of interesting is that we can find a condition on the strict positivity of this lower bound. So this is not a condition for the strict positivity of this capacity, but a condition on the lower bound. But it turns out that it can be expressed as an other capacity of the channel, the Chernoff capacity, when we are measuring the mutual information with the Chernoff distance. So this we can call the Hoofding capacity of the channel, and this is the Chernoff capacity of the channel. So these relative entropies somehow appear when we are considering finitely many uses of the channels. And it should be noted that we cannot get a similar bound with the relative entropy here. So it's not possible to give a bound where here we have the whole evo capacity and here we have a function that only depends on epsilon and not on the channel. And another comment is that if you are considering IID extensions of the channel and product state encoding, then asymptotically this gives the whole evo lower bound. So even though we have this looseness that for small epsilon we get some negative lower bound, asymptotically it vanishes and becomes tight. And proving this result, we were using techniques developed by Hayashi, who used this to show an upper bound on the error exponent of channel coding for classical quantum channels. Okay, so this is about applications to channel coding. And how much time do I have? 10 more minutes or something? Okay, this will be a very fast overview. So it turns out that we don't actually have to consider arbitrary measurements when we want to discriminate states, but we can restrict ourselves to so-called Neyman-Pearson tests, which are generalizations of maximal likelihood tests. And because time is really short, I will not really define anything precisely here. The important thing is that they have a parameter. So unlike this is the maximum likelihood for classical this is the Neyman-Pearson for classical, and we use this parameter A to tune between the importance of P and Q. So this is a completely symmetric situation, and here we are introducing the asymmetry with this parameter Q. And to generalize to the quantum case, we consider this difference of the density matrices, and this is just the projection onto the positive part of the spectrum of this self-adjoint operator. And it turns out that these Neyman-Pearson tests are minimizing a certain combination of the error probabilities. Namely, if we consider this combination of the error probabilities, then the lowest possible value we get when we are using the Neyman-Pearson test. And the Neyman-Pearson lemma, well, this is the Neyman-Pearson lemma, which is very simple but also very important, because it says that if you have a test which has the same error probability of the first kind as the Neyman-Pearson test, then the corresponding second kind error probability should be at least as big. And vice versa, for the error probabilities of the second kind, we have a bond between the error probabilities of the first kind. So this basically says that it's enough to consider Neyman-Pearson tests instead of general tests. And these are projections, so these are not randomized tests. These are deterministic in classical terms. And this is somehow in the heart of this information spectrum method studied by Hanwer, Duhayashi, and Nagaoka mainly, and other people also. And it turns out that we get the Chernoff bond and the exponential decay rate of the Neyman-Pearson test with parameter zero. And the Hoeffding bond with some other parameter AR, then we have to choose AR such that this condition is satisfied. And similarly for Stein's lemma, again, we get this by choosing A to be the mean relative entropy of the states. And one half of the Chernoff bond was solved by using this beautiful operator inequality, which is actually a very robust tool to handle all kind of problems like this. So this is in the heart of half of all the state discrimination problems, and these applications to the error exponent and our lower bound on the channel capacity, they all work because of this lemma, which was actually presented by Konrad Udenaert in the previous conference, in the operator structures conference before this one. And it turns out that we just have to plug in A and B chosen this way, and then we get some upper bounds on the decay rate of the error probabilities of the first and the second kind. And I will not spend much time here. And just a final thought, that the original proof of Stein's lemma, the method is basically to reduce it to classical hypothesis testing. So classical hypothesis testing is well studied. So if we manage somehow to relate our problem to a classical problem, then we are done. And what was done in the case of Stein's lemma is that one just takes the alternative hypothesis and looks at the pinching of the other hypothesis corresponding to the spectral decomposition of state, of this state. So we are looking at the commutative subalgebra generated by this sigma, and we reduce everything to this commutative subalgebra. And asymptotically, it turns out to be optimal. But that's only because Stein's lemma is, so somehow we have this family of hypothesis testing problems parameterized by this R in the Hoeffding problem. And Stein's lemma is somehow an extremely asymmetric situation. And if you are considering less asymmetric or symmetric situations, then this method just doesn't work. But nevertheless, it was discovered by Nussbaum and Scola that we can use some other mapping. So if you look at the spectral decomposition of these two density operators, then we can assign classical probability distributions by this formula. And it turns out that if we consider the state discrimination problem for these classical probability distributions, then this is optimal. And the interesting thing here maybe is to remark that this mapping is non-quantum, in the sense that we cannot find a CPTP map from this quantum system to the classical system that would map rho n to pn and sigma n to qn. And this is exactly because the Rényi relative entropies of these two states, the quantum and the classicals, are equal to each other. Okay, and here would follow some explanation about how large deviation theory enters into this problem, but this I will skip. And just mention that well, when we are considering quasi-free states of fermionic or bosonic systems, then they are usually specified. They have a symbol which is somehow related to the one-particle Hamiltonian of the system, and they can be described by some function on a new-dimensional torus. And these limiting Grignard relative entropies can actually be computed explicitly. And the method here is this multivariate extension of Segre's theorem about the spectral properties of truncations of large Toeplitz matrices, Toeplitz operators. And in spin chains, another method is to show that somehow the infinite state on the infinite chain can be cut up in a way that if we multiply the two half-infinite states, then somehow they provide good lower and upper bound for the original state. And if we can show it for one state, then we can just reduce everything to the IID situation very simply. And the examples here are the global Gibbs states corresponding to some translation invariant finite range interactions and some finitely correlated states. Okay, so as a summary, we have studied binary state discrimination in an asymptotic setting with simple hypotheses, so just one state here and one state there. And it turns out that it is enough to study this Neyman-Pearson test, and actually it is enough to determine the asymptotics of this combination of the error probabilities. And in various settings, Chernoff-Bond, Hovind-Bond, and Stein's lemma, we can solve the problems after two different conditions, either the differentiability of the limiting Grignard relative entropies or this factorization property. And I should point out that the whole thing can be divided into two parts. One is a very general argument establishing this condition of that everything works under this differentiability condition of factorization property, and it's a totally different part to show that some classes of states satisfy some of these properties. And also the techniques used to show this depend largely on the class of states we are looking at. Okay, and these results provide some operational interpretation to these generalized relative entropies, and they also have some applications to channel coding, and there are a class of open problems. Yeah, thank you very much.